The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Jackson has the opinions of the court in case 23-1002 Hewitt versus United States and 23-1150 Duffy versus United States.
Section 924C of Title 18 of the United States Code criminalizes possessing a firearm while committing other crimes. Before the First Step Act was enacted in 2018, federal judges were required to sentence Section 924C offenders to stacked 25-year periods of imprisonment for each second or subsequent Section 924C conviction, even if those convictions were part of the same criminal offense. As a practical matter, this meant that courts had to impose sentences that lasted decades or even centuries on many first-time Section 924C offenders. Congress eliminated this harsh mandatory minimum penalty in Section 403A of the First Step Act of 2018. And, importantly for present purposes, in Section 403B of that act, Congress made Section 403A's more lenient penalty partially retroactive, meaning available to some but not all offenders who had committed Section 924C offenses prior to the passage of the act. Section 403B states, quote, "This section shall apply to any offense that was committed before the date of enactment of this act if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed as of such date of enactment," end quote. The question presented today concerns an edge case. Which penalties apply to a Section 924C offender who had been sentenced for their offense before the First Step Act was enacted, but that sentence was subsequently vacated such that the offender must now face a post-act resentencing? We hold that in such a circumstance, a sentence has not been imposed for purposes of Section 403B, and therefore the First Step Act's more lenient penalties apply. To reach that conclusion, we look first to the words that Congress chose in Section 403B. Notably, the operative phrase was not written in the past tense or past perfect tense, excluding anyone upon whom a sentence had been imposed. Rather, Congress employed the present perfect tense. So at the time of resentencing, judges must ask whether a sentence has been imposed on the defendant. And the present perfect tense requires some relevant connection to, well, the present. If the act in question is entirely a relic of the past, it does not follow naturally from Congress's use of the present perfect tense. To understand this distinction, consider a hypothetical. Suppose the U.S. Olympic Committee enacted a rule stating that athletes may call themselves Olympic champions if a gold medal has been awarded to them. Under that rule, a U.S. sprinter who took first place a decade ago in the Olympic 100-meter finals could validly proclaim today that she is an Olympic champion. But if that sprinter was stripped of her medal in the intervening years because she used performing-enhancing drugs, she can no longer call herself an Olympic champion under the rule today. She had been awarded an Olympic medal, but that action was entirely undone. The same concept applies here. Petitioners Hewitt, Duffy, and Ross were sentenced for multiple Section 924C convictions under the harsh pre-First Step Act 25-year stacked sentencing scheme. But their sentences were vacated after the passage of the act, so they had to be resentenced. Petitioners argued at their resentencings that the act's lessened mandatory minimums should govern. And today, we agree, employing essentially the same analysis that generated the outcome in my Sprinter hypothetical. That is, while petitioners had been sentenced prior to the enactment of the First Step Act, by the time of their resentencings, those initial sentences had been vacated and were relics of the past. Thus, the sentencing judge should have determined that a sentence has not been imposed on them for purposes of Section 403B, and as a result, should have applied the First Step Act's lessened mandatory minimums. Our conclusion is also supported by the nature of vacatur. When interpreting statutes, we recognize that Congress legislates against the backdrop of certain unexpressed presumptions. And one such presumption is that vacated court orders are void ab initio and thus lack any prospective legal effect. By operation of legal fiction, the law acts as though the vacated order, conviction, or sentence never occurred. That principle applies here as well. A vacated sentence does not operate to prevent a defendant who is being resentenced from receiving the First Step Act's penalties. Instead, only extant sentences with continuing validity preclude application of the First Step Act. For those reasons, and others we lay out in our opinion, we reverse and remand the judgment of the Fifth Circuit. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch join all but parts 4 and 5 of the court's opinion. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion in which Justices Thomas, Kavanaugh, and Barrett join.
Justice Gorsuch has the opinion of the court in case 23-1275, Medina versus Planned Parenthood, South Atlantic.
The federal Medicaid statute offers states a bargain. When states accept federal Medicaid funds, they must agree to spend the money in accordance with various statutory conditions. One of those conditions, the so-called any qualified provider provision, requires states to ensure that any individual eligible for medical assistance may obtain it from any provider qualified to perform the service. Everyone agrees that if a state fails to comply with that condition, or many other conditions listed in the Medicaid statute, the federal government may withhold some or all of the state's Medicaid funding. This case poses the question whether, in addition to that remedy, individual Medicaid recipients may sue state officials for failing to comply with the statute's any qualified provider provision. The Medicaid statute itself does not give individuals permission to sue. Recognizing as much, the plaintiff in this case, Julie Edwards, asserts that a separate federal statute, 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, permits suits to enforce the any qualified provider provision. Section 1983, Ms. Edwards observes, authorizes private parties to sue state actors who violate their rights under the Constitution and laws of the United States. And she says the any qualified provider provision confers on Medicaid recipients an individual right, enforceable under 1983, to select preferred health care providers. We disagree. The federal statutes do not confer rights for purposes of 1983 as a matter of course under this court's precedence. And that's particularly true of statutes like Medicaid that are enacted pursuant to Congress's spending power. The spending power permits Congress to offer funds to states with conditions attached. In that sense, spending power legislation resembles a contract. States agree to give up something in exchange for federal funds. When a state fails to comply with conditions in spending power legislation, the typical remedy, again, is for the federal government to cut off the state's funding. If Congress wishes to depart from that norm by authorizing private enforcement suits, our precedents have long held, it must speak clearly and unambiguously. That way, a state knows that it must answer such suits as a condition of the federal government's offer, allowing it to voluntarily choose whether or not to accept federal funds on those terms. For those reasons, we have recognized that spending power legislation cannot provide the basis for a Section 1983 enforcement suit unless Congress speaks with a clear voice and manifests an unambiguous intent to confer an individual right. Nothing less than that will suffice. Those longstanding principles, which this court reaffirmed just 2 terms ago in a case called Tlaibski, resolved today's dispute. In contrast to other statutes that confer enforceable rights under Section 1983, the Any Qualified Provider provision nowhere mentions rights, nor does it focus on an individual's entitlement. Instead, the provision speaks to what a state must do to participate in Medicaid. Doubtless, like most legislation, perhaps all, the provision seeks to benefit people. But the statute does not clearly and unambiguously deploy rights-creating language. The surrounding statutory context confirms as much. For one, the Any Qualified Provider provision appears in paragraph 23 of 87 within a subsection titled Contents that outlines scores of things a state's Medicaid plan must include to qualify for federal funding. All of those requirements are directed not to the rights of individuals, but to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who must approve any plan that meets them. For another, to continue receiving federal funding, the Medicaid statute says, a state need only comply substantially with the Any Qualified Provider mandate. That focus on aggregate compliance suggests that the statute addresses the state's obligations to the federal government, not the rights of any particular person. Observe as well what it would mean if the Any Qualified Provider provision did create an individually enforceable rights. Many other Medicaid plan requirements would likely do the same. And instead of remaining atypical exceptions, as our decision in Tlaibski said they are, rights-creating provisions might become more nearly the rule. For these reasons and others detailed in our opinion, the judgment of the Fourth Circuit is reversed and the case is remanded for further proceedings. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion. Justice Jackson has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan have joined.
Justice Sotomayor has the opinion of the court in case 23789, Gutierrez versus Sines.
For nearly 15 years, petitioner Ruben Gutierrez has sought DNA testing of evidence recovered from the scene of a murder he was convicted of committing. He urges that the DNA evidence, together with newly discovered evidence, will help him prove that he neither participated nor anticipated the stabbing at issue here. With that, Gutierrez says, he can show that he is innocent, or at the very least, that he should have never been sentenced to death under Texas law. When the local prosecutor refused to test the relevant DNA evidence he kept in his custody, Gutierrez sued the prosecutor under Section 1983. He argued that Texas's procedures for obtaining DNA testing violated his rights under the Due Process Clause. The district court agreed, at least in part, and granted a declaratory judgment to that effect. The district attorney appealed that decision to the Fifth Circuit, but that court never addressed the merits of Gutierrez's due process claim. Instead, it said that Gutierrez lacked standing to sue the DA in the first place. Even if a federal court declared Texas's procedures unconstitutional, the court said, the local prosecutor would be unlikely to turn over the physical evidence for DNA testing, so his injury could not be redressed by a favorable court decision. This court now reverses. We held just 2 years ago that another Texas prisoner, Rodney Reed, had standing to sue a local prosecutor who denied him access to DNA testing. We explained there that if a federal court concludes that Texas's DNA testing procedures violate due process, that court order would eliminate the state prosecutor's reliance on Article 64 as a reason for denying DNA testing. That would remove a barrier between the prisoner and DNA testing and therefore redress his injury, at least in part. The same is true here. The declaratory judgment Gutierrez requested would redress his injury by eliminating the state prosecutor's allegedly unlawful justification for denying DNA testing. Sure, the state prosecutor might eventually find another reason to deny Gutierrez's request for DNA testing, but that does not mean Gutierrez lacks standing to argue that the presently cited reasons violate his rights under the Due Process Clause. Because the Federal Circuit held otherwise, the court reverses or remands for further proceedings consistent with the opinion. Justice Barrett filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justices Thomas and Gorsuch joined.
Justice Alito has the opinion of the court in case 23-1270, Riley versus Bondi.
This case concerns the deadline for contesting removal from this country. Under the immigration laws, such a petition must be filed within 30 days of a, quote, final order of removal. In this case, the Fourth Circuit held that this 30-day rule was jurisdictional, and it therefore dismissed Petitioner Riley's petition for review. We now decide two questions. First, the 30-day deadline cannot be satisfied by filing a petition for review within 30 days of a Board of Immigration appeals order in a withholding-only proceeding. That is a proceeding in which the issue is not whether an alien will be removed, but where he or she will be sent. As we have previously said, such an order is not a final order of removal. Second, we hold that the 30-day filing rule is a mandatory claims processing rule, not a jurisdictional rule. The government has told us that it does not plan to pursue the timeliness issue, so we vacate the judgment below and remand for further proceedings. The opinion of the court is joined in full by the Chief Justice and Justices Thomas, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Jackson join in part. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion. Justice Sotomayor has filed an opinion dissenting in part that is joined in full by Justices Kagan and Jackson, and joined except as to part four by Justice Gorsuch.
This court will next sit tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. At that time, we will announce all remaining opinions ready during this term of the court.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.